Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Outshine by Nicole Vann, narrated by Shiromi Arserio. Prologue. The Blue Drawing Room, Kinningsley, the seat of Viscount Linwood, Herefordshire, England, November 12th, 1826.
You are wrong, Daniel. No, I'm not. It's the only correct explanation, Jasmine. You just said so yourself.
Daniel Ashton paced before an enormous paned window, hands shaking, breathing serrated, all of him jagged, shattered pieces. He refused to meet the gaze of the petite, dark-haired woman standing across the room, arms hugging her upper torso. It was already bad enough to feel the weight of Jasmine Linwood's pity. He had no desire to actually witness the tears quietly slipping down her cheeks.
"I know this is difficult," she began, her tone placating, as if he were a little brother she was about to reproach.
That Daniel considered himself to be her honorary younger brother was beside the point.
"No. Scaling a cliff is difficult. Running a marathon is difficult. This..."
He paused his pacing to point a shaking finger at her.
"This is a living hell I refuse to accept."
"Daniel," a hiccuping sob, "sometimes the logical answer isn't the correct one."
"No," he roared, finger still pointing, still shaking. "You might be a mystic, but that doesn't mean you understand everything going on here. You cannot take this from me."
He gasped out the last words, spinning around to face the window, emotions choked, acrid and burning in his throat. Hope. He had to cling to hope. Because without hope, only madness and despair existed. Daniel was used to living in shadows, but this time was different. If he couldn't fix this, the darkness would never leave, never lift, boundless in its breadth, fathomless in its depth. Some wounds were too deep to ever heal. The best he could hope for was an uneasy coexistence. Breathe in and out. One day at a time. Unbidden, his eyes darted to a wooden box resting on a table beside the window. The box that had become his constant companion. Not for itself, but for what it contained.
"Promise you will keep it for me. Don't forget."
Guilt crushed his chest in a destructive vice. How could he have done this? Daniel kept secrets and solved problems for the most powerful men in the world. He was considered by some to be one of those powerful men. He would fix his mistake, correct his wrong.
"Daniel, please."
"No," lungs heaving. "Till the day I die, I will never stop fighting for this."
Silence. His razored breathing echoed through the room, mingling with Jasmine's quiet weeping behind him. He would never agree with her. He had to have absolution. There was no other way. And then, between one heartbeat and the next, something changed. The entire world hushed. Motionless. The very air portent-laden. Years of spy work had Daniel's senses instantly screaming danger. He stilled and turned, meeting her watery, wide-eyed gaze. He shook his head.
"Something is wrong."
Abruptly, Jasmine flinched as if hit by an unseen force. She screamed, pain-filled agony, arching backwards, mouth an O of horror and anguish. Daniel lunged for her, catching her convulsing form an instant before she hit the floor. Jazz, her entire body jerked in a seizure, eyes rolled to the back of her head. "Jasmine!" Then he heard it. A deep rumble from far away, drawing nearer. Like a steam locomotive. Or a vast mining explosion. Or an airplane during takeoff. The sound reverberated. A sonic boom? No, it was a... The windows rattled. The floor shook, Items danced across tabletops. Chandeliers swayed. Daniel clutched Jasmine's convulsing body to him, pulling them both to the middle of the room, barely dodging a vase toppling to the floor. He had experienced earthquakes before, one on a rare family trip to Disneyland as a child. He and his sister, Kit, had clung to the motel bed as the TV rattled and car alarms blared, all long before the time portal in Dwyer Cottage had forever altered the trajectory of his life. The rumble turned into a roar. A jet engine of sound. Daniel tensed, ready to crawl underneath the large grand piano for protection. He held Jasmine closer, her body still twitching. The shaking abruptly stopped. Both the Earth's and Jasmine's. He cradled her suddenly limp form in his arms. Chest heaving, he noted the cries of servants, the frenzied barking of dogs. Timothy, Lord Linwood, desperately calling for his wife.
Timothy, Jasmine moaned, face deathly pale.
Timothy is coming, Jazz.
Daniel brushed hair off her face.
We'll get you help.
Abruptly, her eyes flared open.
No,
she clutched his coat. Jazz?
The portal.
Her terrified blue gaze met his, voice agitated.
Daniel, something has happened to the time portal.
Chapter 1. The East India Docks, London, England. Mid-morning on July 24th, 1828. No one expected a ruddy fishwife screeching at drunken sailors on London's South Docks to be a venerated peer of the realm. And that was the one and only beauty of Fanny McCusker. She was the perfect alter ego for a spy. Which allowed Mrs. McCusker, a.k.a. Daniel Ashton, Lord Whitmore, to shriek insults with impunity at his quarry, a merchant ship's captain smoking a pipe across the street.
"Captain, your mum's so daft she climbed a glass wall to see what was on the other side,"
Daniel shouted at the man. Nothing like a yo mama smackdown, Regency-era style. Captain Adams turned his head. With her broad girth, penetrating voice, smattering of facial hair and complete lack of social filters, Fanny McCusker was expert at extracting information in the most obnoxious way possible. The wise ran when they saw her coming.
"What did you just say about me, Mum?" the captain snarled, taking a step Daniel's way.
Captain Adams was many things. Wise, thankfully, was not one of them.
"Your mum's teeth are so yellow, God said. Let there be light. And your mum just opened her mouth,"
Daniel jeered.
"Shut your trap, woman. Make me."
Captain Adams lunged toward Daniel. Bingo. Daniel hitched up his boned corset, clapped a hand on his bonnet, and took off for a side alley. Captain Adams hot on his heels. Reaching the back of the alleyway, Daniel ducked into a recessed area where his right-hand man, Garvis, waited. Captain Adams rounded the corner, only to stutter to a stop, eyes huge as he stared down the two barrels of Garvis's pistols.
"Have a seat here, Cap'n."
Daniel kicked a stool in the man's direction.
"I just wants to have a wee chat."
Captain Adams, however, had not risen to his levels of infamy by backing down from a fight.
"I got nothing to say to you, woman,"
the man sneered, raking his eyes over Daniel, clearly weighing his chances at outmaneuvering the two of them. Daniel chuckled. It was not an amused sound.
"I wouldn't do it. I suggest he sit, Cap'n."
Today would be Fanny McCusker's grand finale, one last appearance before Daniel retired, God willing. After nearly 10 years in the Home Office serving the Crown, the persona of Daniel Ashton had evolved into the legendary public figure of Lord Whitmore, renowned for his daring feats, a man somewhere between Robinson Crusoe and Ivanhoe. The captain hesitated.
"You're trying me patience."
Daniel's voice was deceptively calm.
"Shall I have me man shoot you right on your left kneecap first?"
Without blinking, Garvis shifted one gun to point directly at Captain Adams's knees. Daniel and Garvis had their routine down, not so much good cop, bad cop, as
Bad cop, even worse cop. Captain Adams was not unimpressed. He licked his lips. Over the years, Daniel's exploits and extraordinary methods of gathering information for the Crown had made him the subject of newspaper rumours, broadsheet cartoons, ballads, a dreadful threepenny opera, and as of late...
How do you know I won't Whitmore you? The captain asked.
A verb. Daniel filed that under signs it was time to retire, when the general populace considered your name so synonymous with secrets and unexpected clandestine behaviour that you became a part of speech. Bow out when his career had hit its zenith, so to speak. Over the years, Daniel's assignments from the Crown had consumed an absurd amount of time and energy, something he saw as both a pro and a con. A con because it left him with less time to pursue personal matters, specifically finally fixing his terrible mistake of 2 years ago and resolving the problem of the time portal. A pro because his attempts to solve those two problems had met brick wall after brick wall. Currently, he was at an impasse without a way forward or back. His espionage work provided a welcome distraction from the bleak darkness of his thoughts. A rogue blast of anguished guilt shot through his chest, instantly tightening his breathing. What was he going to do now? He had to solve this problem and leave behind these 2 years of self-loathing and pain and torment. Don't go there. Focus, Daniel. Garvis fired a warning shot, splintering rock and wood next to Captain Adams's right knee. The man flinched and yelped. Daniel flowed into action. He seized the captain's arm and twisted it around between the man's shoulder blades, expertly applying pressure that almost dislocated the captain's shoulder, causing excruciating pain. Captain Adams collapsed to his knees, roaring in agony.
"Or maybe Fanny here will Whitmore you instead," Garvis drawled.
Daniel bent the captain's arm further.
"Here now, Cap'n. Let's have a wee chat, shall we? Start by explaining how large sums of newly minted money ended up in wine casks aboard your ship."
Without waiting for a reply, Daniel applied more pressure, and between the captain's screams, elicited the information he needed. Mind distracted, he eked another couple hours of living, avoiding the guilt that threatened to crush him into dust. Chapter 2. A hackney cab, London, England. An hour later, on July 24th, 1828. She should not have come. She should have stayed at home, safe in the shell of her anonymity, remaining as she had always been, the background wallpaper against which others lived their lives. Pride was one of the seven deadly sins for good reason, and at this moment, Fossey Lovejoy was far too guilty of it. But she had travelled 124.9 miles already. 'Twould be cowardice to not see the thing through when only 2.4 miles remained of her journey. And Fossey Lovejoy was many things at the moment. Furious, outraged, indignant. But cowardly was not one of them. Righteous anger had a way of fortifying one's spine, she had discovered. Lord Whitmore could not be allowed to steal from her. The hackney cab rocked along the crowded London street for another half a block, and then suddenly lurched to a stop, throwing Fossey forward, knocking her knees against the opposite bench. A quick glance out the window showed that two enormous wagons, one filled with wine casks, the other with wooden crates of hissing geese, had managed to tangle their wheels. Naturally, the drivers felt the need to expound upon the other's stupidity, family heritage, and reproductive habits at colourful length. Heavens, London is certainly proving educational. Fossey sat back on the seat, twisting her gloved hands, wondering for the 53rd time since breaking her fast at the Bourne Rose Inn, if pride and outrage justified her transgressions. Mentally, she catalogued her sins over the last 3 days. First was the lie she told her father. She was not, in fact, visiting an ailing school friend of her mother's in Bath. The good Reverend Josiah Lovejoy, erroneously assumed the elderly woman was paying for Fossey's travel expenses, which led to her second transgression. Fossey was a genteel lady travelling alone without a chaperone. Her pitiful savings only supplied enough money for one person's transportation, not two. Bringing a companion had been out of the question. Not that Fossey needed a chaperone. Her reputation, such as it was, could hardly suffer from this trip. A lowering thought, but nonetheless true. Her financial status, poor, age, 32 this past summer, and education, far more expansive than sensible, already ensured her spinsterhood. No person in England was more unmarriageable than a plain, aging, poor, clever woman. It was impossible for her chances of matrimony to sink any lower. A black mark on her honour would simply be another shovelful of dirt on an otherwise deeply buried dream. Granted, that knowledge had been scant comfort on the overnight mail coach, when trying to sleep between a farmer's wife who reeked of onions and a sweaty businessman whose hands had a distressing tendency to wander where they shouldn't. Then there was the vanity and pride of wishing to protect her work from Lord Whitmore's exploitation, which had been the catalyst for this journey in the first place. The cab lurched to life, moving slowly through the crushing traffic. A fruitmonger argued with a flower girl. A weathered old woman played a hurdy-gurdy hanging from her neck. A street sweeper held up carriages while he cleared the road of manure and filth so his patrons could cross on relatively clean ground. London was different and yet exactly what Fossey had always expected. Loud, noisy, chaotic. A sea of humanity. But in all her imaginings of London, she had never considered the smells. Coal smoke, rotting garbage and mildew, the stink of stagnant water and cattle stockyard and unwashed bodies. The last smell in particular seemed ground into the Hackney itself, not to mention the floor of the cab, which Fossey found disturbingly sticky. She glanced for the 61st time at the magazine clipping clutched in her gloved right hand. It had appeared in Scriptus Mathematicus, the foremost scholarly publication for the Society of Mathematicians, a society to which Fossey belonged. Or rather, a man named Foster Lovejoy belonged. Women were not welcome within the society, naturally. Fossey could not afford a subscription to Scriptus Mathematicus, but instead relied on friends within the mathematical community to forward copies to her. This particular notice in last month's journal had instantly captured her attention. The clipping showed a complex mathematical equation and then ended with the words, "One who knows the solution to this equation should present himself and the solution to Ashton House in Mayfair, London." Fossey chewed on her cheek. The fact of the clipping was nothing out of the ordinary. Others entreated the society for answers to mathematical questions with shocking frequency. It was the what of the clipping that made Fossey's blood stir in righteous indignation. The equation displayed was hers, a creative idea she had scribbled in her notebook one night several months ago. She had talked to no one about it, shown it to no one. But there it was, nonetheless, distinctly recognisable parts of it published in Scriptus Mathematicus for all the world to see. Why had Lord Whitmore taken her theorem? Of all the secrets in Britain, why had he chosen to pilfer hers? Well, she assumed Lord Whitmore had taken them, or at the very least ordered the pilfering done. Thanks to newspaper reports, everyone in Britain knew who resided at Ashton House, particularly after the events of last April, when Mr. Daniel Ashton had miraculously foiled an assassination attempt on the king. Mr. Ashton had been gravely wounded as a result, adding to his aura of power and mystique. In gratitude for his service to the crown, Mr. Ashton had been elevated to Baron Whitmore. The society broadsheets had been rapturous about the new Lord Whitmore, the elegance of his person, the intelligence of his parliamentary speeches, the largesse of his fortune. It was said debutantes swooned when he passed them at Almack's. The man had become a verb, for heaven's sake. The news rags, of course, loved depicting him. Lord Whitmore regularly appeared in the political cartoons of Mr. Cruikshank. The Lord Whitmore of those drawings was an autocratic figure,
meticulously dressed in the latest fashion, staring down the opposition with icy eyes. In one memorable sketch, Lord Whitmore rises with collected superiority from the hatch of a large wooden horse, surprising dishevelled Trojan soldiers, who look remarkably like his political opponents. The cartoon, of course, was the very definition of being Whitmored, an unexpected act which caught one by surprise and changed the outcome of events. Daniel Ashton, Lord Whitmore, was a master of secrets and surprises. But why had he concerned himself with her secrets? Had he deliberately stolen her theorems? And if so, why spy on Fossey Lovejoy? Whitmored indeed. Fossey had no previous experience with the upper echelons of the aristocracy. While her mother was yet alive, they had on occasion called upon Sir Peter Nobley, a local baronet of some self-declared importance. He had enjoyed practicing his schoolroom Italian with her mother, and she had enjoyed speaking the language of her maternal grandparents. That was the beginning and end of Fossey's interactions with the peerage. But her father had ensured she was well-educated in the vagrancies of the aristocracy, the depths of their depravity, the heights of their pride, the loftiness of their self-regard. To say that Daniel Ashton, Lord Whitmore, was out of her sphere of social interaction was a gross understatement. Fossey had no delusions as to her own importance. Life had never allowed her such luxury. Lord Whitmore would see himself as a shining star to her pathetic grain of sand. She knew herself to be completely invisible. Brown hair, brown eyes, a height that was neither too high nor too low, a figure that ran neither too lean nor too plump, though a friend of her mother's had once remarked that Fossey's complexion was quite fine. Externally, Fossey was utterly forgettable. But inside, oh, inside, she was colour. Vibrant reds and oranges and blues, poppies and bluebells, a blistering summer sunset after a glistening rain. A pity her inside had never made itself known upon her outside. Lord Whitmore would view her as a chafing bit of grit, one to be hastily dispatched. But here she gripped the magazine clipping more firmly. She couldn't let this pass. Even a tiny speck of sand, when correctly placed, could make itself felt. And if she had to stubbornly scrape at Lord Whitmore until he explained his actions to her, well, she was prepared to be an irritant. Chapter 3. Ashton House, Mayfair, London, England. A while later, on July 24th, 1828. Fossey tapped her booted foot, watching as the bustle of the inner city gave way to the wider streets and calmer atmosphere of what she could only assume was Mayfair. Elegant people in elegant clothing walked elegantly down streets which were elegant, of course. Fossey had landed in one of the fairy tales she told her nieces and nephews. Only she was certainly no Cinderella, and fairy tale dreams were a luxury she had relinquished long ago. Her muscles felt stretched thin, taut and jumpy. She found herself humming an Italian aria, one of doom and despair. It was more than just nerves, this restless energy. Since receiving the clipping and deciding on this course of action, her emotions had gone topsy-turvy, and she hadn't a clue how to write them. The hackney finally creaked to a stop in front of an imposing townhouse, three stories of marble columns topped by a large pediment. She paid the cab driver after a brief haggle over current versus historical values of the shilling and how that related to hackney cab fares. The man was not amused and drove off with frightening alacrity. Fossey waited for one of those elegant couples to pass her before facing the looming front steps. Purposefully, she reached into her reticule and swapped the magazine clipping for a smaller piece of thick white paper. Armed as much as she could be, she sucked in a deep breath, straightened her shoulders, and marched up the stairs, rapping the knocker with a firm hand. A decidedly top-lofty butler opened the door and peered along his prominent nose at her. He raked her up and down with a dismissive sniff. "The servants' entrance is around the left, opposite the mews." The door slammed in her face. Right.
She had hardly come this far, braving onions, wandering mail hands, and outrageous cab fares to be kept out by a condescending butler. Gritting her teeth, Fossey rapped again. Mr. Toplofty opened the door, scowl deepening.
"I am here to see Lord Whitmore," Fossey said in her most educated accent. She swept past the man into the cavernous entrance hall. Fossey might be poor, but her mother, God rest her soul, had insisted she behave like a lady. Not that her mother would have approved of Fossey barging into a gentleman's home unannounced, but, oh bother, she was determined.
"His lordship is not at home to visitors, madam."
Mr. Toplofty's scowl morphed into a full-on glower.
His unspoken words being, "His lordship is not at home to visitors such as yourself."
Perseverance, Fossey. "I have endured the travel of 127.3 miles, nearly 235,000 wheel rotations, not to mention the consistent friction between the forward momentum of the carriage and the counter-up-down propulsion of rutted roads, resulting in a nearly constant jarring war of forces." Fossey stopped. The butler's eyebrows had merged with his hairline.
"Focus. Basically, I am a person of great patience, sir. I am happy to wait in this vestibule until his lordship is at home to visitors such as myself."
Fossey knew something that perhaps eluded Lord Whitmore in his gilded palace. When you had so little in life, you defended the few things that were yours with ferocious tenacity. No aristocrat would take her theorems from her, not even the infamous Lord Whitmore. Fossey extended the slip of paper to the butler.
"My card for his lordship."
Mr. Toplofty took the calling card she had prepared before leaving home and turned it over, reading what was written on the opposite side. The man froze, eyebrows still standing at attention. She had rested his interest, at least. Mr. Toplofty raised his head, mouth drawn down.
"It will be some hours yet before his lordship returns."
"As I said, sir, I am prepared to wait. This chair here will suit my needs."
Fossey gestured toward an ornate side chair, flanking an equally ornate side table just inside the front door. The butler's expression froze.
"Lord Whitmore will not be amused by your waiting in his entryway, Miss Lovejoy."
Fossey was quite sure that was code for Mr. Toplofty would not be amused by her waiting in his entryway. She took two steps to the side and sat down on one of the chairs.
"I don't particularly care what Lord Whitmore thinks."
She fixed him with her best schoolmarm look. When one was a spinster, one had to use the weapons at one's disposal. Before the day was out, Lord Whitmore would rue trying to steal from her. Given how Mr. Toplofty's lips twitched, she thought he might actually agree with her on that point. A townhouse near Piccadilly, London, England, around the same time on July 24th, 1828. Daniel stood tapping a top hat against his leg in the well-appointed front parlour of Mr. Edward Stewart, Esquire. Garvis leaned against the mantel, face grim and threatening. After his questioning of Captain Adams, Daniel had stopped by one of his halfway houses and shed the trappings of Fanny McCusker. He was now attired as Lord Whitmore, from the shoulders of his meticulously brushed coat to the bottom of his glossy, champagne-shined Hessian boots. Unlike Mrs. McCusker, Lord Whitmore exuded wealth and power, wrapped in unemotional ruthlessness. A man of legendary exploits who had the ear of the king himself and excelled in Whitmoring the unsuspecting. Lord Whitmore was someone to be feared. And given what Daniel now knew about Mr. Stewart's nightly visits to the Royal Mint, courtesy of Captain Adams, the man had every reason to be terrified. Which explained why Mr. Stewart was on his knees begging for clemency. It was an unfortunate pose for many reasons, the least of which being the unobstructed view it afforded of the man's sparsely populated hairline.
"My wife, my young son, what will become of them?" Mr. Stewart darted terrified glances between Daniel and Garvis. "Have mercy."
Daniel merely raised an unimpressed eyebrow. Lord Whitmore was not known for his mercy. Garvis cracked his knuckles to emphasize the point. Edward Stewart blanched. Daniel tugged on his left coat cuff,
face an impassive mask. I am not the originator of your pun.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?